From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. With Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders having garnered about 27% of the New Hampshire primary vote in a still crowded field of candidates on Tuesday, he declared decisive victory. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Peter Buttigieg came very close, however, and will walk away with 9 delegates, the same number as Sanders. 4 years ago, Sanders beat Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire with almost 60% of the vote. So why didn't he do as well this time? The primary races have only just begun, of course, and much remains up in the air in a critically important election year. We turn now to Larry Bensky. He was the national affairs correspondent for Pacifica Radio from 1987 to 2007, and he anchored numerous live political events, including national party conventions. He's a longtime teacher at Cal State University, Hayward, where he teaches courses like the American presidency. Larry won a George Polk Award for his coverage of the Iran-Contra scandal in 1988. I'm so pleased to welcome him. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you again, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about your impression of the past two primaries, the very first two primaries in the nation that, get so much critical importance simply because they're first out of the gate. The Iowa caucuses from last week that were quite disastrous, and then Tuesday's New Hampshire primary, which was a more traditional primary. In both cases, Bernie Sanders did win a plurality of the popular vote.
Yes, he did. And this whole, as I like to think of it, charade of democracy, which goes on every 4 years when we have these exhaustive and exhausting contests for nominations for president, is once again proved to have new wrinkles this time in the very earliest stages. As you mentioned, the disaster in Iowa when they couldn't get the votes counted in the caucuses, and then when the fragmentation of the candidates was so great that nobody was able to have a decisive victory despite what Bernie Sanders and Mayor Buttigieg may have suggested. No, there's no way in the world this was any kind of a victory for either of them. At the best, it was not a loss. Now, people should keep in mind here that even though the mainstream media especially is obsessed by this process because it's a way of quantifying social trends and political trends, the polls have been coming out for forever, and people have been maybe looking at the polls a little bit in the mainstream media, as I said, or on websites like Real Clear Politics, which aggregates the results of polls, and which I recommend to listeners who want to get as obsessed and obsessed about this presidential race as some of the mainstream media hysterics are. I recommend that you tamp it down by looking at actual numbers, and that some of the wiser interpreters of these numbers, hopefully this program will help you look at those. But one thing that stands out in my mind, that as the total number of Democrats who voted in both Iowa and New Hampshire, as you aggregate those and add them up, 460,000 people voted. 460,000. There are more people than that, registered voters, in Fresno County alone in California. In other words, the numbers are infinitely tiny. They amount to something like 0.17% of the people who will vote and the delegates. And as far as delegates go, there are going to be something like 2,000 delegates to the Democratic Convention later this summer. So far, something like 143 have been selected. 143 out of 2,000. So these are very, very early stages, baby steps, if you will. And also, the registration for voters and how it breaks down is not at all certain yet in any of the primary states that are coming up, or indeed in any of the states, all of whom will vote, of course, next November. We have no idea what the electorate is, who's going to be in it, where it's going to be, et cetera, et cetera. All we have is this very, very slight indication of results to date. And I wouldn't take these all very seriously if one is going to get ecstatic or depressed about who the candidates might be.
So, how do you explain, as I asked in my introduction, how do you explain why Sanders didn't do as well in 2020 as he did in 2016? Is it that he had a bigger array of moderates to campaign against compared to one clear moderate or centrist rival, which was Hillary Clinton last time?
Will you promise me one thing, Sonali?
What's that?
For the rest of this interview, don't use that word moderate. It's completely meaningless. It's a refuge for people who appear on television and radio and indeed in print media to get out of taking any responsibility for what they're talking about. It's a way of taking away any kind of power and energy that progressives or even liberals might have by trying to make the American people think that the American elective is intrinsically, supposedly not progressive, and certainly not revolutionary, and certainly not even radical. But in order to fit into the framework of electoralism, which people need to remember is an industry, it's a business in this country. People make hundreds of millions of dollars as consultants, as pollsters, as designers of campaign ads, and now, of course, as designers of disinformation and misinformation websites. It's a huge, huge industry backed by hundreds and hundreds of millions, indeed billions of dollars. One man alone announced today, Sheldon Adelson, the extremely conservative, pro-Zionist newspaper owner and business owner, casino owner in Las Vegas, he announced the day after the New Hampshire primary that he intends to put $100 million, that's million with an M, himself, just himself, into trying to re-elect Donald Trump. $100 million. Donald Trump, of course, could finance this out of his left pocket with another $100 million, and probably will. People like Michael Bloomberg think that he's qualified to be president merely because he can pump maybe $300 million or more into this campaign. This is not democracy in any way that people need to define democracy. And the idea that you can buy votes, which is all that this is really founded on, buy votes of people who will defeat any kind of radical change, which this country so desperately needs, in my humble opinion, by saying you can't elect anybody who's for tuition in colleges to be free. You can't elect anybody who believes that we should have medical aid paid for by a single payer and get rid of this entire insurance and pharmaceutical company, excuse me, insurance and pharmaceutical company monopoly. You can't get through that barrier of stealing, if you will, which the mainstream media and, as I said, the electoral industry has put upon the possibilities of the American people to express themselves as they have many times in the past over American history. You mentioned in the introduction that I teach American presidency courses in university here in Northern California. And one of the things you learn as you teach, and teaching should be learning in addition to teaching, is that there have been numerous times in American history when people have said, you can't do this, Andrew Jackson. You can't do this, Thomas Jefferson. You can't do this, Abraham Lincoln. You can't do this, Woodrow Wilson. You can't do this, Frederick FDR. You can't do this, LBJ. You can't do this because you can't do it because the American electorate will not back it. And they've been proven wrong again and again and again. And it's quite possible to be proven wrong this time too, because we don't know, first of all, what's going to happen between now and November, but I guarantee there will be many events that will twist and turn public opinion, quite possibly in a more radical direction than the mainstream media allow for in their framing. But it's also quite possible that people will revert back to their traditional ways of seeing these elections, and which is to say, and this is a very disturbing trend that has already started to form in Iowa and New Hampshire, people will revert back to the default position that American voters have, which is if it's too confusing, if it really doesn't offer us anything that relates to our lives, if it's too much framed in a way that I can't relate to, if I'm stereotyped too much, if I'm expected to vote a certain way because I'm African-American, if I'm expected to vote a certain way because I'm Jewish, if I'm expected to vote a certain way because I am wealthy, if I'm expected to vote a certain way, et cetera, et cetera, I don't want to be one of those people who does what's expected, and I don't see what the alternatives are because I don't want to concentrate on this mess in the first place. And so what do? They don't vote. And the turnout in both Iowa and New Hampshire so far has been very low compared to what people were predicting in the pre-vote polls. We'll see if that holds up in the next couple of primaries that are coming up. But so far, I see that as a tendency that we need to follow.
Larry, it seems as though every other day there's a new poll, either of a state or a nationwide, or, you know, a hypothetical head-to-head between Trump and the Democratic candidates, or of all of the Democratic candidates. Sometimes there are days when there are two major polls that are out. Is there too much polling? And especially, you know, since we understand so devastatingly the pitfalls of polling from the 2016 presidential election, do the polls just serve to muddy the waters and contribute to that confusion and potential apathy that we might get among voters?
They can, but I think you need to look at the polls as you might look at the pharmaceutical companies who are represented in the pharmacies and the prescription medicines. If they don't give you advertising, if they don't bring forth supposed results-oriented studies, which they do themselves, of course, so they're totally self-interested, if they don't do these things, then their industry loses billions and billions of dollars. If the electoral politics industry, and that's what it is, it's a big business, if it doesn't do the polling, then first of all, the pollsters don't get paid. Second of all, the people who interpret the polls don't get paid. Third of all, the people who design all kinds of campaign messages based on what the polling shows, they don't get paid. And you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars and, not coincidentally, tens of thousands of people who don't get paid. So you've got an industry which needs to be self-perpetuating. Its product is electoralism. Its product is not democracy.
So, there are now some fears, and I know that we have only had two primary races, but given the fact that Amy Klobuchar is polling well nationally and Pete Buttigieg, of course, is rising, that the field is not becoming clearer. Sanders may be getting a lot of votes, but he's not getting majorities. There's a fear that there may be a contested convention this summer in Milwaukee, the DNC may be a contested convention. That could be extremely problematic and quite frightening, I think.
Well, it's frightening in the sense that it would provoke a reversion to the worst of the elements of the electoralism system that existed before primaries were put in as reforms. People will remember that we didn't have these primary elections through most of the history of the United States, and indeed most states still don't have them, or the caucuses. But what the system substituted for those was the so-called smoke-filled rooms. Of course, the arenas were also smoke-filled. So if you had a convention in a place like the Milwaukee Convention Center or Madison Square Garden in New York, notoriously, smoking was allowed in there, and you could cough yourself to death just by walking in the door. But they won't be smoke-filled, but there will be a lot of backroom deals going on if, as you say, the convention is not decided by delegates who have been selected beforehand. And what that means is that the power, and people are not mentioning this, you hardly see any mention of this at all. You really have to dig deep. You don't see any mention of the fact that the Democrats, in addition to the delegates who are selected through these primaries and caucuses in many states, also have things called superdelegates. And those superdelegates are selected by other elected officials in the system. So it's another way for the system to perpetrate itself. And their votes will become much more important if there should not be a clear winner when the delegates are totaled out of all of these primaries and caucuses beforehand.
Larry, let me ask you about the Democratic establishment, Democratic Party establishment's response to the Sanders candidacy. There was a time when they started to seem to embrace Warren over Sanders, but now that she's sort of dropped in the polls, it seems as though every other day there's a new, excitement about, well, it must be Buttigieg. He's going to save us. Bloomberg's the one to save us. Klobuchar's rising in the polls. Anybody but Sanders. They seem more frightened of a Sanders presidency than of Trump winning re-election.
Yeah, there's a little game we play at the breakfast table in our house, my wife and I. We see how far we can get into that day's New York Times print edition, which is delivered to us, before we come across a trash Sanders story or a trash the Democrat progressive story. And it's in there every single day. Voters are starting to think again in Wisconsin. Maybe Trump isn't so bad. Bernie Sanders, my God, they may be okay for Vermont, but he's not okay for here. X in our state, he's never shot a gun, which is not true. He has. He's never roped a cow. I'm sure he's never done that. But they always try to find some way in which Bernie Sanders is not what Bernie Sanders backers know that he is, which is a thoughtful, nuanced progressive who happens to have a relatively radical point of view. He calls himself a democratic socialist. I don't think any socialist in Europe and the socialist parties that have existed for so long would recognize his politics as anything like socialism. But the mainstream media is terrified of legitimizing the Medicaid and Medicare proposals that Sanders has, of the green approach that he and his administration would take to global warming. They're terrified of that because powerful business interests are at stake. They're terrified of the tax system becoming more equitable because more equitable would be that the rich would pay what the Sanders people call their fair share. They don't want to pay their fair share. They want to pay an unfair share, which is what they now pay. And the task for Sanders, or indeed any of the other Democrats, if they get the nomination and Trump is the Republican candidate, which is not certain yet either, by the way, but the task for any of them will be to show that all of his talking about how there was an establishment and a Washington establishment and the rich and they ruled us all of that was true and he's done nothing about it but make it worse. His tax cuts have enabled more people to become wealthy. They have hit the middle class and certainly the working poor more than anybody else. And they want to see it continue that way, the Sheldon Adelsons of the world. And there are plenty of them out there, and they go put a lot of money into disinformation campaigns. I don't know if you watched any of the Super Bowl. My guess is probably you didn't, Sonali,
No,
but
I
I did.
didn't.
Before, during, and after it, there were Mike Bloomberg ads. And what was
Yeah.
Bloomberg beating his chest about? He had Glory, hallelujah, saved African Americans from eternities in prison by criminal justice reform or by advocating for criminal justice reform, which is nonsense. He saved almost nobody. And insofar as there has been
Quite
criminal
the
justice,
opposite, right?
it's the opposite. And insofar as has been some criminal justice reform in getting people who were serving absurd sentences for possession of small quantities of marijuana, insofar as that is now on the decline somewhat, and it wasn't on the decline for social justice reasons, it was on the decline because it was too expensive for the federal government and the states to keep these people locked up forever for nothing. Bloomberg is taking credit for it, and his ad had nothing but African American faces in it. Glory, hallelujah, my son's home, and some guy would be being embraced by his grandma and his kids who he hadn't seen in 10 years. I mean, it was the most disgusting play upon emotions and for fragments of emotions. African American people aren't stupid, and neither are other people in this country. And to put up what is basically a socio-political electoral minstrel show on television in the form of an ad and say, "Here's Mike Bloomberg. St. Michael has done this for us in New York. He could do us for us nationwide. All we've got to do is elect him president." For that to be the platform for an advertisement during the Super Bowl of all places, which shows you the type of audience that they're going to reach out for, is really so far a low note.
And I just want to just make an aside on the Bloomberg thing. It was on Tuesday that audio of his speech at the Aspen Institute given in 2015 was made public. He had given a speech where he defended stop and frisk 3 years after he stopped being mayor of New York. He is claiming today that he reduced stop and frisk by 95%. The Intercept had an article by Li Fang saying that actually he increased it sevenfold. So he's literally lying about his role in the racist policing aimed at Black and brown men in New York City and trying to win over endorsements from the Black community and from, you know, any of us who consider ourselves anti-racist. It's pretty shocking, but it seems as though Bloomberg thinks he can just throw money at the problem and whitewash his record.
Yes, he does think that, but don't forget, lying has become normative now in national politics. Donald Trump's, I don't know what the count is, 6,000-7,000, or the fact checkers for, you know, places that do such things, like you mentioned The Intercept, but also The Washington Post does this, The New York Times. They keep a list, and every once in a while they'll run it, or they'll have it constantly online. You want to see the 7,000 misstatements, distortions, and outright lies Donald Trump has told on his Twitter accounts and every place else ever since he's been president and before? Well, they're all out there for display. So for Bloomberg to add his tiny little spark of disinformation and misinformation to the mix has now unfortunately become a normative element. And we can expect that to continue as this campaign season unfurls.
Well, finally, Larry, let me ask you this. Looking ahead to the primaries that are coming up quite fast, I mean, within weeks, we've got the Nevada caucus, the South Carolina primary, and then we've got Super Tuesday, where, you know, huge number of over a dozen states, including for the first time early California voting. Much could be clarified about the field of Democratic candidates in just the next few weeks. Do you care to make any predictions?
No, I don't care to make any predictions other than that. I'm voting very soon. My ballot is sitting here facing me at home. They've consolidated the polling places around here in Northern California. So it used to be half a block away, and now it's four blocks away to go vote, and et cetera, et cetera. But I think that there's all kinds of intriguing possibilities, including somebody who's not now in the race jumping in and making some sort of splash on the Democratic side and possibly even on the Republican side. I think that you have enough people there and enough possible mixtures of people so that, for example, if it was amenable to both of them, a Sanders Klobuchar ticket would have a lot of strength in various ways. They would have differences which would be brought up endlessly by the Republicans, but differences don't seem to matter if you can state your positions strongly enough. One of the other statistics I'll leave you with, as far as the New Hampshire caucuses this week went, 2/3 of the Democratic voters, according to exit polls, support free tuition for higher education, which of course is one of the cornerstones that Bernie Sanders has been hammering at for years. 2/3 of the Democratic voters and 60% support single payer, which the mainstream media would have you believe is the end of our health care. We're all going to die. We're all going to drop dead. We're all not going to have any money. Bad things will happen if we get the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies out of the business of health care. But the voters seem to agree on that, those two issues and their others, with Sanders. So if he can keep the discussion on the issues and off of all the extraneous nonsense, the words socialism, for example, or the words, and here I'm going to use it, and I said we couldn't use it, the word moderate. If we can keep it labels and keep it on to issues, yeah, then Sanders have a much better chance.
Right. The worst that Trump can throw at Sanders is that he's a communist, and he's already done it. And Sanders has responded saying the president clearly doesn't know the difference between a socialist and a communist, which I thought was a pretty good response. Larry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sonali. And thank you for hanging in there all these years and doing so much good work.
I appreciate it.
Hope to be back with you again in not too much time.
Absolutely. My guest has been Larry Benske. He was the national affairs correspondent for Pacifica Radio from 1987 to 2007. He anchored numerous live political events, including national party conventions. He's a longtime teacher at Cal State University Hayward, where he teaches courses like the American presidency. He won a George Polk Award for his coverage of the Iran-Contra scandal in 1988. We've been discussing primary election season. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.